Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today, as we approach the end of 2017, we'll look back on the first year of the Trump administration and search for some glimmers of hope amid the dark clouds at home from the destruction of our domestic tranquility and the diminution of America's standing abroad as Trump undermines democratic values while encouraging authoritarianism and white nationalism. We'll begin with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the bombing of Cambodia. He joins us to assess the extent to which Newton's law applies to our domestic and foreign policy in terms of every action having an equal and opposite reaction. We explore whether Trump's avarice, amateurism, ignorance, and cynicism will eventually catch up with him as the huckster who promises bigger and better things delivers less and less. We'll look into how already there are impressive signs of opposition forming at the grassroots, which is likely to build as more and more Americans recognize the hollow and fraudulent nature of the empty promises coming from the White House, while the criminality and kleptocracy of this regime comes under increasing scrutiny from the special counsel, who Trump might well fire as Mueller gets close to indicting him. Then we will speak with the director of a new film that takes on the issues of immigration and race relations roiling America and Europe and deals with the ugly reemergence of white nationalism. Fatih Akin, the director of In the Fade, a feature film out of Germany starring Diane Kruger, joins us to discuss this drama about a German woman seeking justice for the terrorist attack that killed her Kurdish husband and son. Based on a real incident involving young German neo-Nazis who killed Turks living in Germany, the movie reflects the political tensions resulting from immigration in Germany today that Donald Trump has inflamed here at home and which emerged in Charlottesville. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And as we wrap up 2017 and 2018 fast approaches, 2018 being a critical year, the year in which the Democrats, if they take back the House, they may well proceed with impeachment. But one never knows with Donald Trump at what moment he's going to fire the special counsel. That's a real possibility. In fact, we're pre-taping this between the holidays, so it could have already happened. So it's very difficult to keep up with the daily antics of the White House, and it seems to be a deliberate strategy on the part of this reality TV star who's now got the ultimate reality TV role, which is the survivor in the White House, and he throws out chaos on a daily basis, I think, as a way to hide his incompetence. And it's almost as if it's government by stunt on a daily basis. Do you think we can endure another year of this, let alone another 3 years?
Well, I think we can endure it. Whether we do it in good form and good shape is the question. You know, there's a sense, Ian, in which Donald Trump is quite a positive development for reform and for change in the United States. I've never seen more active mobilization at the grassroots among what's left of the Democratic Party and most hopefully of what's new in activists and citizen participants who are in the political process for the first time simply because they're terrified, appalled, and generally shocked at this presidency. So it's taken a pathology, as it were, to stir this kind of reform impetus in the United States, and I think that will last over time, staving off some kind of calamity, some kind of disaster in foreign policy of course, is the urgent task of the moment. And as you well know, there are lots of opportunities for that in the coming year. This is not going to be a quiet time for America abroad. I think we've discovered in 2017 that the world can live without American leadership, and even in the shadow of a kind of American madness in the presidency. But whether the world can also live with some kind of mad, impulsive act, of course, is yet to be seen.
Well, the fact that President Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital to bolster the Christian Zionist vote in Alabama to help elect a child molester gives you an idea of the reckless lack of priorities here in this administration. So it's not inconceivable that if he's capable of something like that, he's capable of a wag the dog war, is he not?
Well, he certainly is, and I think that very much depends on how he sees his own fortunes, and that in turn may depend on how competent and thorough the special counsel is. I think there's no question that Donald Trump is improvising in the sense, and it's kind of a deliberate improvisation, in the sense that as a reality TV character, he's living day to day and trying to project the best image he can. He lives in his own universe, of course, and it's a universe of his own ethics and morality and his own sense of the truth. The country, it seems to me, as I said, is doing better in the sense that it seems to me more aware, more conscious of politics and of the system, of the fix and favor in Washington. You can see that every day in the demonstrations that are mounted against the Congress and against the kind of implicit and explicit compromise and surrender that's going on. We would not have seen that, I think, under a Hillary Clinton presidency. We have not seen it under Barack Obama or even George W. Bush at the height of the public opposition to the Iraq War and the appalling character of that government, of the Bush-Cheney duopoly. We didn't have this kind of public outrage, and I do think that's quite positive, but it's always possible that this man can act in an irrational and impulsive way, as you say, to wag the dog, to try to turn around what he regards as a threatening moment in his own presidency.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. And of course, Roger, this year has been dominated by Russia and the Mueller investigation, of course, which I mentioned could be shut down at any moment. There's clearly a propaganda campaign underway led by Fox News to slime and discredit this otherwise highly praised individual, Robert Mueller, a Vietnam War hero, Republican appointee to the FBI. And an all-round, highly respected figure until Rupert Murdoch decided to unleash his junkyard dogs on Mueller. What's your sense of whether there'll be some resolution? I mean, it was extraordinary a week or so ago when the former head of American intelligence, the director of national intelligence, General James Clapper, in an interview on CNN, basically said that Vladimir Putin is Trump's case officer, and Trump is Putin's asset. An extraordinary statement coming from the top intelligence or the former top intelligence figure in the United States. So there's this disconnect. The intelligence community, which rarely agrees on anything, it's a big deal to have everybody line up and say that Russia did interfere in our elections. Trump defies that, keeps calling it a hoax. The right-wing Republicans, who normally were red baiters and Russian haters and Soviet haters, are now all covering up for Trump, which is extraordinary. And even people on the left, like the Nation magazine editors and Oliver Stone and Susan Sarandon and that crowd on the loony left, they're all making apologies. So I don't understand why people don't get it. I mean, unless they believe that they're so alienated from their government that they think that anything that the intelligence community has anything to do with is some kind of lie.
Well, I think it's been an established fact, as you and I know, in the American intelligence community, and not just the CIA, not just the Director of National Intelligence, not just the military, or NSA, or any of the feudal fiefdoms of that world, but all of them together consensually, that this was a major a Russian operation, that it involved the collusion and cooperation to some extent of the Trump campaign. And I think also there's been a conviction that they're dealing, and this is Mueller's conviction, I'm sure, they're dealing with a kleptocracy in power in America, which is in collusion with the Russians, and that Donald Trump has been compromised in fundamental ways, not just in the campaign, but previously in his own business dealings. I think that's the moment and the significance of Mueller looking at the business history of the Trump empire, as well as the immediate history of collusion and the issues of obstruction of justice and all the rest. I don't think Mueller is going to be affected to any degree at all by the propaganda campaign of Fox News or Rupert Murdoch. I don't think he's affected by the dishonor and the treachery, really, has to be called that, of the Republican Party or the Republican Congress, which has, as you said, historically reversed themselves in terms of being the champions and protectors of national security to now being the champions and protectors of their own political power. And it's done, of course, in ignorance, but mostly in fear of what the Trump base can do to them in 2018. And that's going to happen anyway. I don't think there's any question that Mueller will come down with a series of devastating findings. Whether he directly implicates the president or not, he will turn this administration into the disgrace that it certainly is. In light of history, there will be prosecutions, there will be convictions, there will be an attrition of major players, both in the campaign and in the administration itself. It's arguably not only the most inept, but the most corrupt administration in modern American history, and certainly the most pathological in terms of the animus and instability of its leader. So Mueller is dealing with an absolutely singular historical moment, and I think we could not have had a better man for that, a better personality. He's stoic and quite serious and professional. He's got the best staff of lawyers, of prosecutors, probably in the history of government prosecution. I think this is going to be a climactic moment in American life. And yes, it will be a constitutional crisis if he tries to fire Mueller. And yes, it will be an awful test of the Republican Party and of Republicans in Congress, which I think they will, for the most part, fail. But I do think that the prosecution will survive. I do think that history's verdict will be clear, and we're just going to have to live through the terrible moment here. The death throes of this old era are going to be dire. And as I said earlier, staving off catastrophe is the order of the moment. I think in the long run, there will be a major rebellion in the American electorate. You'll have a new Congress in 2018. I think you'll certainly have a new president in 2020, if not before. And I think that all of that is is very hopeful, but it's going to be a close-run thing.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Roger, since we're taping this earlier than the broadcast, one doesn't know that whether or not during the holidays Donald Trump will take advantage of the distraction and fire Mueller. So whether it's a done deal or not, it seems very much that it's going to be in the cards. But to my mind, a lot of damage has already been done, not just because of these extraordinary reactionary policies and these horrible people that Trump has put in charge of all these government departments, whose mission is to destroy the functioning of these government departments. As we all know from the recently passed tax bill, it's an obscenity. A man who ran as a populist against Wall Street and against Hillary Clinton, who he painted as a creature of Wall Street, has now shown total contempt for his voters, even though they loyally follow him and are in the Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair bubble, believing him and thinking everything else is fake news. That's where I think the damage has already been done. I don't know how a country, let alone a superpower, can survive where there's no consensus on what is real and what is true anymore. And that is an export from Putin, from Putin's Russia, from his political technologist, Surkov, the idea that nothing is true and everything is possible. And Bannon and others seized on that, not to mention the active involvement of Russian cyber activities, bots and troll farms, etc. But an example, for example, is I think one of the reasons why Bannon was running Roy Moore down there in Alabama was that had the U.S. Senate elected, or had the Republicans elected, a child molester to the U.S. Senate, that would just further spread despair, which is the whole strategy of Putin and Bannon, is to spread despair, lower the bar continually to the point where nothing is sacred, so that the criminals can take over.
Well, I all of this is true, Ian, but I would just come back in a, I hope, in a somewhat more optimistic vein for the new year. All of this is reversible. The tax bill can be reversed, and almost certainly will be. All of the savaged protections that have been demolished by this administration, from the environment to any kind of social enlightenment that we managed over the last 25 or 30 years, the last dismantling here of the New Deal and the Great Society, all of that can be reversed by a Democratic Congress and by a new Democratic Party, which I do think is emerging. There isn't anything that cannot be changed, including the Congress, the presidency, all of the legislation that's being imposed. Now, there will be damage and pain and suffering in the meantime. There's no question about that. What bothers me, of course, is the irreversible. And the irreversible, as we know, not to be too grim about it, would be a major war of any kind, a nuclear attack of any sort, any kind of constitutional usurpation that Trump may attempt. But I really don't think he's up to that. And I really don't think in the final analysis even the Republicans are up to that. This is a party that's going to be transformed and changed themselves by the defeats of 2018 and 2020. There will be an opening of a way to a more serious and responsible conservatism, rid of the rancid dogma and rank atavism that has emerged in this party, not just in the Trump era, but been cooking and simmering for a long time now. But all of that is reversible in terms of American democratic politics, if the order holds, if the United States remains what's left of a constitutional republic, and that's what has to be protected and maintained at all costs. I'm very hopeful that we're going to see a renewal of American democracy and of the American republic in the wake of the ravages of Donald Trump. But we must survive him first, and that means keeping intact the republic as we know it.
Well, adding to your list of the irreversible, of course, is the judiciary. And Donald Trump is making the most appalling appointees to the federal bench, totally unqualified ideologues and ignoramuses. I mean, it's shocking. Now, mercifully, a couple of the more dreadful ones have been rejected, but the idea that you can actually see on television a candidate for a federal judgeship who's never conducted a trial and knows nothing about the law, is that's the height of contempt, it would seem.
Well, I know that, but I would even say there that there is some hope, because the judiciary, again, as we know, is not immune to the political climate of the moment. These are know-nothings and reactionaries now, and many of them will make it to the bench, not all of them, but many of them will. And they will survive, of course, in public service, as it were, beyond the Trump era. But their judgments, their verdicts, their thinking, their politics, and there is a politics in that branch of the government, as we well know, will certainly be affected by the climate of the company. And the country is going to change, I think, for the better. And they're not going to be there forever. The judiciary is a large and varied body. He's not going to be able to take it over. He is going to be able to influence it. And they will harry and diminish justice for a generation, perhaps for decades. But again, it's not irremedial. And I think they will be influenced by the changes that I see coming in the wake of the Trump era, as will the Republican Party, as will institutions in general. I think we're going to come out of this much better, Ian, than we went in. But we, of course, have to survive in the meantime.
Well, curiously enough, the change and the optimism that you're expressing, Roger Morris, and it's definitely manifest, the change in this country seems to be being led by women.
Oh, I think that's certainly true. You know, that's in a sense, and that's always been true. I remember being in the White House and looking out at those massive demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, and reflecting on the fact that much of that was being led at the grassroots by young women. It wasn't just the furtive young men trying to escape the draft, and I knew many of those, but women have always been a motive force, often the motive force in American reform, and not just in terms of getting the vote, but certainly in terms of civil rights and all the rest. And they are leading the charge. And what's happened with the utter revolution in exposing and calling out and punishing, really, with the kind of retribution that's long deserved, punishing sexual abuse and harassment and all the rest, is part of that revolution. We're seeing an unfinished revolution in terms of women's rights, in terms of feminism in America, in terms of human rights, just as we're about to see an unfinished revolution in American politics. We're going to get hold of campaign spending and of campaign reform in general. We're going to get hold of the abuse of concentrated power and the kind of oligarchic control that's been exercised for so long. Donald Trump has made that possible because he has so starkly represented and portrayed and inflicted all of the worst elements of that old order. And the old order is dying. It's dying in both parties. It would not have died in the same way or at the same pace under a Hillary Clinton presidency. And I know that many of my liberal friends would be appalled at the notion that Donald Trump was better for us in the long run than Hillary Clinton, but there is a case for that to be made. And I think historians will look back at this period in a way which I think will be much more hopeful and much more redemptive than we're seeing it now. Of course, we're living through the worst and the most painful elements, and among the worst, of course, is the sheer uncertainty of what's going to happen in foreign affairs.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, in terms of the best of times and the worst of times. In this retrospective, we've talked about Russia. The other, I think, significant thing that happened this year was the reemergence of neo-Nazism, not just in the United States but around the world, but in particular in Charlottesville. Do you think, when you talk about the old order being vanquished, talk about atavism, bringing back Adolf Hitler is grotesque?
Well, I think that's true. But again, this has been an undercurrent, a dark dark side of the moon in American politics for a very long time. The difference here is that Donald Trump has given it license, given it a kind of respectability, a platform, given it, of course, the kind of notice in the media that it never really enjoyed before. The Nazis had gone out of vogue. You remember it's Skokie, Illinois, and all of that, the furor that arose in the 1950s and 60s, and they had disappeared just as the Klan had disappeared. But that undercurrent of racism is still the unhealed scar in American life and society and culture, and it will be there for a very long time. There will be a core of Trumpian voters, whether Donald Trump is around or not, and they will feel a sense of loss. There will be an element of racism as well as economic grievance in what they represent and in what they feel. We're not going to be without challenges and without difficulties ahead. But Donald Trump really has brought the worst of this to the fore, and I think given us the opportunity to deal with it and to overcome it, to transform both political parties, which was the essential ingredient, the essential prerequisite to any kind of meaningful reform in American life. This has not been done just by the Republicans alone, as we well know. It could not have happened without the Democrats, without the collusion and complicity of the Democratic Party, without its surrender and compromise in 100 different ways. And Donald Trump has afforded the opportunity to change that in the ranks of the old democracy, as well as in the political system at large. So I don't mean to be naive about this, Ian, but honest to God, I feel a more sense of optimism amid the gloom here, despite the blight that we're living through and witnessing in American politics. I think this ordeal it offers the opportunity and the hope and the real enlivenment of change in American life.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is about the history of the inner politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the director of a new film that takes on the issues of immigration and race relations roiling America and Europe, In the Fade.
No sickness, toil or danger, that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Fatih Akin, a documentary and narrative filmmaker whose films include Head On, Crossing the Bridge, The Edge of Heaven, Polluting Paradise, The Cut, and his new feature film, In the Fade, which stars Diane Kruger, and it premiered at the 2017 Cannes Film Festival, and it'll be released in Los Angeles and New York today, December the 27th. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fatih Akin.
Thank you very much.
And the film is, it's a pretty amazing piece of work. I have to congratulate you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I was very affected by it. In fact, it's going to be difficult talking to you about the film because I don't want to give anything away. I mean, the ending is just devastating. So we'll try and navigate our discussion without giving too much away.
Let's try that.
So let's begin with the broader political context. We're just learning now that German lawmakers, I guess because of the success of Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing party, which I think is now, is it not the second biggest or third biggest political bloc in the Bundestag? Lawmakers now in Germany are talking about maybe repatriating Syrian refugees as the war winds down. Many would be sent back, I think, against their will, because many fled because of what Assad was doing to the country and to the Sunni majority. So something's changing in Germany. Everybody was impressed, I think, at least progressives were, at how Angela Merkel handled this situation compared, say, to Hungary, where the sort of neo-fascist government there behaved very badly. So as a German citizen of Turkish descent, Ryan, how do you see the current political climate vis-a-vis immigration?
Right now, we don't have a government, you know.
That's true. Well, presumably the socialists will come back into the fold, won't they?
Yeah, they talk about like coalition programs, you know. Yeah. I think finally it will not be like re-elections. I think finally it will turn out that the grand coalition between Social Democrats and the CDU, the Christian Democrats, they will work together again for the next 4 years. And as with somebody with a background with a Turkish heritage, there is a certain crisis right now in Germany. And I think this crisis, somehow it reminds you to the crisis of the Weimar Republic, mm-hmm. you know, in the 20s. But that was an economical crisis. And this crisis opened the door for the NSDAP, Hitler's party, to lead to the Third Reich. And what we have today is, on the one hand, a very successful coalition in the last 4 years in terms of economic. Germany is a very economical
success.
There is not really a poverty, like there is not really a poorness there. You know, you have education for free and you have medical insurance. If you are out of employment, state carries for you. The out of employment rate is less than 5%.
Right.
You know,
but and still, you get what, a month holiday? What is the national holidays in Germany?
Yeah, I think it's around a month.
Right.
It's around a month. But still, we have a crisis, you know, although the economics works kind of like perfectly.
Right. So it's a political crisis.
We call it the refugee crisis.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we name it, you know, and it is the result of the war. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a global matter. You know,
right.
It's the war in Syria, I mean.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people, not just right-wing fascist people, but I mean, like people in the middle somehow, they start to be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their fear somehow is rising because the fear of losing their, I don't know, cultural identity or something like that. Or
Religious identity. Sure.
The fear of arising of, I don't know, criminal activities on the street, you know.
Right.
Where the media is fault for, you know, because there is not this thing like that. And the expression of that fear is leading into these the rise of this Alternative for Deutschland party, which is, in my eyes, a semi-fascistic a group.
And that's the polite face of the people in your film who commit the crime. In other words, there's a kind of neo-Nazis. They're real neo-Nazis, right? So the AfD would be, how would you compare them to the people in your film that are the ones that are behind the crime?
There is a certain ideologic connection.
Right.
Between the polite fascism of the AfD, you know, the extreme conservative of the AfD and the ideologies of the neo-Nazis in the film, who are, I don't know, somehow socialized by the Third Reich. There is a connection, you know.
Right. Well, there is also in this country, there's a connection between the Republican Party as a whole and the alt-right faction of the Republican Party, represented by Stephen Bannon,
yeah.
who is a powerful voice.
Yeah.
And as you know, I'm sure, when the horrible incidents took place in Charlottesville, Virginia,
yeah.
where fascists, American fascists, holding Nazi flags
yeah.
and shouting blood and soil and, you know, Hail Hitler and all this stuff, Trump said there were good people on both sides. And that shocked a lot of people. So we have a similar problem, not as acute as it is in Germany, because Merkel took in about 1 million refugees, did she not?
Yeah, and, you know, you have to know, we have different histories.
Of course.
You see, so the waves of Charlottesville and Trump's reaction on that mm-hmm. that hit us hard in Germany, you know, because mm-hmm. everything what has to do with Nazi Germany, with the Third Reich, is somehow very delicate in our society. It's part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we have a culture in Germany of reflection. You know, we have 3 years in school, you know, we have the education for the Third Reich and how it happened. You know, we have a culture of guilt in Germany, which is, I think, a positive thing, you know, and the most countries don't have that, you know, and I always compare it with Turkey, where my parents are from. They don't have that. I mean, they did like Armenian genocide, you know, and
they still deny it to this day.
They still deny it until this day because they don't have this culture of guilt. And so I think it is here in the States. You don't have that, really, this culture of guilt. That's the difference, the main difference between that Trump is able to say something like that, you know.
Right. But you have, as you pointed out earlier, in Germany, you have free education. You have good education. Here, our education system is collapsing, and it's now being taken over by a right-wing evangelical woman, a billionaire, who wants to get rid of all the public schools and make everybody go to these Christian schools where they teach all kinds of stupid, ignorant stuff about they're against evolution, they're against environmentalism, all kinds of strange stuff. So my concern about America is not so much that we don't have the guilt, but we don't have the education anymore. We used to be the leader. California was the leader in the world in university education up to about the 1970s. And now it's collapsing. So I know it's a little off the subject matter, but I wanted to point out that difference. That
I think somehow it belongs to the subject because it's a complicated subject.
Right.
You know, and complex, you know.
Right.
And very difficult to find a solution for it or to find answers
right.
for it. But one thing is, and this is really concerning me, is Germany is a democratic system. So is the United States, you know. So were countries like Poland and Hungary and even Turkey, you know. And the Weimar Republic was also a democracy. And democracy is something which you really have to defend mm-hmm. because it's so fragile, you know, and it's so fragile that it can be easily taken over by any fascist groups, you know.
We have examples,
you know.
In Poland, it's being rolled back by this extreme right-wing government.
Right.
You just had this massive demonstration in Poland on Constitution Day with
right.
young Poles calling Sieg Heil, marching in the streets, blood and soil, white Europe. This is a country where the Nazis killed so many more. All the worst atrocities took place. Same in Erdogan is rolling back all kinds of rights and shredding Turkish democracy.
Yes.
So is Orban in Hungary. So what you're telling us is very real, that autocracy is on the move. It's growing around the world. I think in many ways it's being emboldened by our president, Donald Trump, because
yeah.
he's an autocrat. He doesn't have any democratic values. He's abandoned human rights and all of the standards of American diplomatic history. And I think it's having a terrible effect. And think about all the autocrats in the world who are on the rise. Putin, Xi, Erdogan, Orban. this is what I fear. The bad guys are winning.
The bad guys are winning because we, the Democrats, or the supporter of the Democrat idea, you know, we made one mistake. You know, we thought like democracy is something for free. You know, it's something what comes automatically, I don't know, in our houses, but it's not. You know, it's something what really has to be defended. You know, and to quote another president, you know, it's like what Kennedy says, one like don't ask what the country does for you, ask what you can do for the country. This is a very important attitude, you know, and I think the only way to stop these movements, you know, is that everybody who believes in democracy has to really fight for it, you know, on no matter which level, you know. This is very, very, very important, because the other guys, you know, the so-called bad guys, they fight for, you know, visible, fight for to get rid of the democracy.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back continuing the conversation with the director of the new film, In the Fade, starring Diane Kruger, Fatih Akin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation in studio by Fatih Akin, who is a documentary and narrative filmmaker, whose films include Head On, Crossing the Bridge, The Edge of Heaven, Polluting Paradise, The Cut, and his new feature film, In the Fade, stars Diane Kruger. It premiered at the 2017 Cannes Film Festival, and it is released today in theaters in Los Angeles and New York. And in terms of this international coalition of bad guys and how much autocracy is on the move in the world and democracy is under threat and in retreat, your film does show that kind of internationalism of these far right-wing fascist groups, because the young German Nazis on trial are joined by these Greek Nazis from Golden Dawn.
Right.
So,
right.
And I must say, you cast those guys brilliantly.
The Greek Nazi in the film, he's a director, Yanis Economidis. He's a very left wing director from Athens. You know? Right. But he has this incredible face, you know. And right. So he, because he dealt a lot with Nazis and neo-Nazis in Greece, you know, so he knew exactly what he was acting.
Right. So it's interesting that they work together, this international coalition of far right wing groups. They help each other out.
Today it's not a big thing, you know, to create such a network because of social media,
right.
You know, because of Facebook and I don't right. know. So these people they're using it, you know. Right. So and then it's very easy right. and very effective
right.
to create these networks all over the world.
Right. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back continuing the conversation with the director of the new film, In the Fade, starring Diane Kruger, Fatih Akin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation in studio with Fatih Akin, who's a documentary and narrative filmmaker, whose films include Head On, Crossing the Bridge, The Edge of Heaven, Polluting Paradise, The Cut, and his new feature film, In the Fade, which stars Diane Kruger. It premiered at the 2017 Cannes Film Festival, and it is released today in Los Angeles and New York. So we should at least tell our audience some of the broad strokes, what the film is about. We start out this conversation talking about the broader political landscape in terms of anti-immigrant feelings growing inside Germany and around the world and in Europe in particular, and here in the United States, fueled in part by Donald Trump, who's taken a very anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim stance from the very beginning. We know that in Germany, it's a very tolerant society, and about a million refugees were let in when other countries treated them very poorly, particularly Hungary, for example. It has not been without problems. You had the Christmas bombing, and then it doesn't take much. A couple of terrorist incidents really turns back the clock and increases the anxiety. And as you were saying, the AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, now is the third biggest party in many ways as a response to anxiety about Europe being invaded by foreigners and Christian values being under assault by Muslim immigrants. So let's talk a little bit about the plot. A German woman is married to a Kurdish German. She starts out in jail,
yeah.
wearing his best suit, and you learn that they're getting married. So it's a flashback in the opening. They're getting married, and then shortly thereafter, you see the extraordinarily loving family that they are, husband and wife and young child. And shortly thereafter, there is a hideous terrorist attack, bombing, and then it's all about who did it. And then eventually we learn, even though the police basically try to say that because the Kurdish husband in his past had dealt drugs, that it was all about some drug deal that went bad.
Right.
And that's the focus of the police. And she, from the beginning, our protagonist, played by Diane Kruger, she knows from the beginning it's the Nazis. That's her first, and eventually they finally have to agree to that. So let's talk a little bit about the police attitude. Is that the sort of attitude amongst the police? You know, let's just solve this as quickly as possible. I mean, there are two things that I hadn't noticed before. I know nothing about the German judicial system, but boy, if that's accurate, what happened in that trial, then it's almost like political correctness has taken over the German judicial system. Is that how much does that reflect reality?
Well, this film is based on a lot of research, and it's also based on a real case. You know, we had the so-called NSU scandal, which still goes on. It's the NSU scandal is between 2000 and 2007. A group of neo-Nazis, young neo-Nazis, it was a trio, it was two men and one woman, they killed several people in Germany by shooting them. You know, they killed nine men with migration background and one German police officer, a female.
Mm-hmm.
And
but they targeted immigrants from Turkey or Kurdistan, where were they from?
Yes, yes. And one was Greek, you know. They're observing these targets, you know.
Right.
Their favorite choice was like people who had like their own stores, you know, like an internet cafe or, mm-hmm. I don't know, a pizza place or
falafel place.
Yes, or, yeah. yes. Yeah. Or these kind of establishment, and kind of like those who made it should be killed, right? And they also used bombs. You know, they dropped some bombs, nail bombs, like the one in the film. And it's a pure chance that nobody died with these bombs. You know, but with the shooting, 10 people were killed, and they were all killed with the same gun. And for 11 years, from 2000 till 2011, police investigation, media, like press, you know, and somehow the society thought these killings were done by the Turkish mafia or the Kurdish mafia, you know, just because the victims had a background. There was no other reason.
Right. These just like people, in your film then.
Yeah, but in my film, the guy, you know, he has a criminal background.
Right.
These people in reality, they didn't even have a criminal background. Right. They were ordinary people, you know.
Right.
And for 10 years, the victims were blamed, you know, so the leftovers could not just suffer, you know, they were also like, they were also, the suspicious persons, you know, they,
mm-hmm.
you know, and after 11 years by random, it came out that that the neo-Nazis did that and not the Turkish mafia and stuff. So before they get caught, the two male neo-Nazis killed themselves, or they say they killed themselves. We don't exactly know, you know. She, the neo-Nazi girl, Beate Zschäpe, she's in trial. The trial goes on since 5 years.
Still going on.
Still going on since 5 years. And a lot of my film is based on that real case, you know, like how the investigations of the police was, you know, certain things in the trial, you know, the father of the neo-Nazi in the trial, you know, when he when he turns towards Diane's character and says whatever he says there without spoiling it, it's it's based on the protocols of the real case.
So no, literally the transcripts of the real
case. Yes, I used the transcripts. I read all the transcripts, and I went to the trial in Munich several times. So I did my homework for that. So so
By the way, that's a powerful scene where she, the father of one of the guilties, the fellow, the Nazis on trial, does talk to her on the steps of the courthouse.
Yes.
But what he says at the end of it is that he knew.
Yes.
And that really does shake you up. You know, and shakes up the Diane character as well. So that's amazing. So is that why at the end of the film you have a little bit of a, you have a graphic saying that a number of people were killed by neo-Nazis? And
it was a long discussion in the editing room if we should use it or not. One of the reasons we used it is that a lot of people don't know about the real case, and I think it's worth to Google it, you know, because the real case, it's so much more complex than what I have in my film. You know, it's so so wider, you know, it's it wouldn't fit into a 100-minute film. You could do a, I don't know, a TV show out of it, you know, a serial, you know. And on the other hand, the real trial is not over yet. You know, it's
that's amazing. It's still going on.
It still goes on in this moment, and I think somehow next year, you know, maybe in the springtime, we will know how if she Beate Zschäpe will get free or not. You know, and and even if they put her, if they give her like a life sentence penalty, you know, it's they will try to. It's kind of like she's the only guilty one, but she isn't. There was a network behind this group, you know. There was this is proof. This is not conspiracy, you know. There was the German secret service, the Verfassungsschutz, you know. They right after the tree were caught, the Nazi trio, the secret service destroyed dozens of files. Because they had like their informers in the neo-Nazis. Informers in the neo-Nazis are real neo-Nazis, but for money they give like some harmless information to the to the secret service. And I believe that these three, at least the two men, had a contract with the secret service that they were that they were informers, and and that was too. Embarrassing for the Secret Service. This is my personal theory.
Right.
You know?
But we shouldn't give the audience that will see the film that opens today in the Fade, opening in New York and in Los Angeles, starring Diane Kruger, that you, Fatih Akin, directed. Because the film is really mostly about how the victim suffers, you know, the survivor, the widow. It's about the journey that she takes trying to navigate the justice system and that turns against her, that the injustice of everything that happened, losing her husband and child, and then I won't give any more away, but that's what the heart of the film is about, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's about how she's punished again and again.
You know, when these things happen, you know, like, I don't know, bomb attacks done by any group, doesn't necessarily has to be done by neo-Nazis, you know, can done by Muslim terrorists, you know a lot about who did it, you know, and Abu Jamal or whoever the name is, you know, did it, and he was in school in London, and his father is a successful medicine. I don't know. You know, we learn a lot about these things. You know, the guy in Vegas. You know, what we don't know, you know, are the victims. The victims are numbers, you know, 47 died or 128 died. And we know less about the leftovers, you know, those who have to live with that. You know, how do they live with that? Their life changed forever, fundamental, you know. It's, you know, and we hear not too much about these people in the press or in narratives, you know. And I was focusing and I was interested in, you know, like how would such a person go on living? I mean, what is a mother if you take a child away from the mother? What stays there, you know? And that was the what was interesting me in writing this.
Right. Well, but that's what you, the way that you convey that through her looking at home movies of her husband and child. I mean, it's very powerful stuff that all she's got are memories.
Yeah, and you know, we live in this days of smartphones, you know, so we can really catch every little moment with our smartphones today.
Right.
You know, so so it's kind of like easy for the audience to identify themselves with the characters through those scenes shot with an iPhone.
Right. Well, there's a certain amount of buzz about Diane Kruger getting an award, but of course, the film is up for best foreign film, right? It's Germany's entry into the Academy Awards, is it not?
Yeah, but the 27th of December, we'll know if it's on the shortlist or not, you know?
Right.
So we don't know. So
you don't know, of course.
Should we talk about, like, the film is on the shortlist?
Well, that opens today. We know that.
Okay.
Bennett, to qualify for the Academy Awards. But if it were to be nominated, it would be in the foreign film category. Not, she wouldn't be up for a best actress, even though in many ways she should be. Or could she be?
Still,
she could.
Yeah, she could.
She could be up for a best actress.
Yeah, yeah. This year, there are a lot of female competitors this year. This year is an extraordinary year, you know.
Of course,
you know, it's
But this is a really amazing performance from her.
She's a great actress.
Yeah,
she's a great actress, and she always was, and she also proved it. I saw that before, in I don't know, independent films she did in France or here, you know, who hadn't had reached such a wide audience.
Right.
But I always knew like how good she really is, you know.
Right.
So I had the opportunity to give her that space and this stage, and she perfectly used it.
Right. Well, I congratulate you for the film. I think it's a great piece of work.
And, thank you very much.
And I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And I've been speaking in the studio with Fatih Akin, who is a documentary and narrative filmmaker whose films include Head On, Crossing the Bridge, The Edge of Heaven, Polluting Paradise, The Cut, and his new feature film, In the Fade, which stars Diane Kruger. It premiered at the 2017 Cannes Film Festival, and it was released today in Los Angeles and New York. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.